Chapter 15. Spire Albion, Habel Morning, Lancaster Vattery. 2 seconds. Grimm and his crew had 2 whole seconds of surprise and confusion in which to advance on the enemy. 2 seconds was a great deal of time when measured in units of life and death. They had covered perhaps half of the open ground before the Aurorans managed to gather their wits and an officer began barking orders, redirecting their aim. The glow of a couple of dozen weapon crystals lit the dimness, shining like spotlights, and they began to pour fire into Grimm's crew, mostly from gauntlets, but also from several long guns. Grimm's men returned fire as they ran, wildly inaccurate for the most part, but anything that helped make the Aurorans flinch or seek cover was desirable. Then it was horrible sound and blinding light and the feel of spirestone beneath his boots as he ran, sword aloft. 2 seconds more. By the end of it, 20 of his men were down, most of them screaming, some horribly still. Others had been hit in their ether silk tunics, and though they staggered as they ran, they kept going. Grimm saw the blast that hit him, slamming home into his ribs. For an instant he faltered, looking down, but the suit the old etherealist had lent him was evidently lined with ether silk of the highest quality. The blast had felt like little more than a stiff punch, unpleasant but hardly deadly, and though it had burnt and torn the outer layer of the suit's coat, the silk beneath was unmarred. And then Grimm had reached the blast-pocked walled garden. The wall was more decorative than functional, being only about as high as his stomach, except where gauntlet blasts had lowered it in gaps to only a couple of feet high. Grimm stomped his boot down onto one such gap and leapt into the garden and passed the rank of men defending the wall, making room for the men coming behind him. He saw a pale face before him and whipped his sword in a quick strike, felt it hit. Then there was a flicker of steel, and he ducked beneath one of the inward-curving talon-like blades of the Auroran Marines and parried a second blade of the same kind. Then Kettle bounded through the gap in the wall, sweeping one large boot into the teeth of the man defending the opening as he did. The helmsman landed, his gauntlet hand stretched out behind him, and put a blast into the head of another defender. And after that it was frantic motion, reflex and terror. Steel flashed, gauntlets screamed, and his crew fought to press into the garden, to put enough men through the wall to make the weight of numbers decide the matter. The Auroran Marines disagreed. These were hard-bitten men, professionals who were trained to excel in the mayhem of battle. They recognized the danger of losing the wall, of being surrounded by a numerically superior force, and they fought savagely, viciously. Grimm found himself driven back, Kettle by his side, while the crew kept trying to follow the pair of them in, only to be cut down mercilessly and precisely by the Auroran long gunners or the blades of the enemy marines. Grimm felt the momentum shift, felt the gathering determination of the Aurorans as they realized that they outclassed their opposition. In a few seconds more, he judged, the attack would be repulsed, leaving himself and Mr. Kettle subject to the attentions of enemy gauntlets. And then Creedy's squad arrived. They didn't shout. They ran in relative silence, their footsteps masked by gauntlet fire, by howls and screams, and took up position along the opposite wall of the garden. Creedy made it happen with excellent discipline. He made sure every man was at the wall, gauntlet lifted, arm braced, aimed, and ready to fire before he gave the order. The Aurorans, fully focused on repelling Grimm's assault, suspected nothing until the moment Creedy's first salvo felled nearly half of them. Grimm lunged forward, driving his sword into the breast of an officer whose silk had absorbed the blast that struck him. Kettle, at his side, intercepted a wild swing from another foe with his own blade, bellowing, "Albion!" As he did, his fellow aeronauts surged forward with a roar, copper-clad blades in hand, vaulting the low wall or leaping through the gaps, swamping the stunned invaders in their numbers. The surviving Aurorans lasted rather less than 2 seconds.
Creedy,
Grimm said a few moments later. Report.
11 dead,
Creedy said in a subdued, solemn voice. 2 more who won't last long. 17 incapacitated by their injuries and as many walking wounded, sir. I've sent those wounded who can move back to Predator with word to send Dr. Bagan at once.
Grimm grunted.
The Aurorans?
3 live. They might not survive their injuries.
Have Bagan see to them the moment he's finished with our own. I should think that the powers that be will want to speak to them, eh?
No doubt, sir, Creedy said. I've put some of the older, calmer hands to guard them.
Good man,
Grimm said.
Send someone to the Vatry and let them know that we're not trying to murder them.
I thought there might be nervous men with gauntlets inside, so I went myself, sir,
Creedy said.
Grimm felt his lips quirk.
I see that they didn't blast you, he noted.
No, sir, Creedy said, his tone serious. Armed retainers of Lancaster, sir, former Marines. Very good discipline. They're staying at their post, and their commander has gone to secure the household. From outside the garden, where the wounded had been laid out together, there was a low, groaning scream of pain. Grimm looked up wearily from where he sat on a bench in the garden itself. There was a small burbling brook and a pool there, along with several dwarf trees and abundant green ferns, quite beautiful but for all the blood and corpses. The dead men stank of offal and excrement, the way they always did. It seemed undignified for a man's last remnants to be so foul, but that was the way of it. Grimm tried to ignore the smell and the motionless forms alike. There were always unpleasant consequences to a battle. He rose, wearily, straightened his back, cleared his throat, and looked into the middle distance.
That was work well done, Mr. Creedy,
in the battle and after. I've known men who didn't have half as much composure or sense in their first close-quarters action.
Creedy hesitated awkwardly before replying. Captains did not say such things to their junior officers in fleet. Creedy frowned at nothing in particular, which also happened to be in the middle distance.
Sir,
he said.
Yes, I don't like it either, Grimm replied. But as I cannot put you in for a combat ribbon or a commendation for unusual competence under fire, we must make do.
Yes, sir.
Grimm nodded.
When time serves, I shall buy you a drink, and we'll not speak of it again.
Creedy nodded. I should think that perfectly acceptable, Captain Grimm.
Good, Grimm said. That's done.
As soon as Bagan gets here, gather the men and get ready to move. There are a great many more Aurorans out there somewhere, and we'll need to be ready to respond.
We captured 4 of their long guns intact, sir. Shall I issue them to the men?
Grimm nodded once.
Excellent notion. Give one to Mr. Stern. He's a fine shot. Have him pick a squad to use the rest.
Aye, sir, Creedy said, and left to see to it.
Captain,
Kettle said from where he'd been standing, silent and discreet, a long step away.
His tone was a warning.
Grimm turned to find a tall man approaching in a black suit tailored almost exactly to the lines of a Marine's uniform. He wore a blade and a gauntlet, and his short brush cut of hair was grizzled. Even before Grimm saw his eyes, he'd pegged the man as warrior-born from his lean build and grace.
Captain Grimm, I presume,
the man said.
Aye,
Grimm replied.
You have the advantage of me, sir.
The tall man offered his hand and Grimm shook it.
Esterbrook,
he said.
First armsman of House Lancaster. I'm glad for your intervention, Captain. 4-1 are stiff odds.
The Aurorans seem to think so,
Grimm replied. 6 of you held off 2 full squads of professional Marines. Impressive.
Brief,
Esterbrook said. Otherwise you'd need to use words like tragic, or maybe noble sacrifice.
Thank you.
Grimm found himself smiling up at the man.
What can I do for you, sir? Lord and Lady Lancaster were in the residence and saw much of what just happened. They wish me to convey their thanks and their condolences for your losses, and to inform you that they have already sent for their personal physicians, and that they're preparing space in the house for your wounded. You needn't fear that your men will lack the best care available."
Grimm felt something ease in his gut that he hadn't known had been paining him.
Please, sir, convey my heartfelt thanks to the Lancasters."
Esterbrook nodded.
"Will."
He looked around and then at Grimm again.
"You're Francis Madison Grimm, captain of the Perilous."
Grimm felt his shoulders tighten.
"Former acting captain, sir. I am he." "I hear the Admiralty broke your sword for cowardice."
Kettle made a growling sound. Esterbrook glanced up, arching an eyebrow at Kettle. But then he turned back to Grimm, clearly waiting for an answer.
"They did, sir,"
Grimm said. Esterbrook showed his teeth.
"But you'll charge a dug-in position of marines, with one arm in a sling."
"It was necessary to do it," Grimm said. "We all serve, sir, some with more glory than others." Esterbrook seemed to consider the multiple meanings in Grimm's answer and said,
"Right. The Admiralty has its head up its nethers again."
Grimm arched an eyebrow and said nothing. Behind him, Creedy shouted out an order, and the remaining aeronauts began to gather together. Bagan had arrived, as had two other men with the distinct confidence and focus of physicians in a crisis. His men were being cared for. He felt his chest ease as if it had been suddenly cut free from tight leather bonds. Esterbrook looked at the gathering men and said,
"You're moving out."
"I can't imagine that the Crystal Vatry was the enemy's only target,"
Grimm replied.
"And I do not think the men we took down were operating alone. They seem to be waiting for some other support to arrive."
Esterbrook nodded.
"What I thought, too. I'd offer to send a few men with you, but..."
"Others may yet attack the Vatry, and your duty is to the Lancasters," Grimm said. "Albion must not lose the Vatry.
I'll leave a squad with you to help secure it until the Marines, or the True Guard, arrives."
Esterbrook ducked his head once.
"I'm grateful to you, Captain. I have wounded of my own. Where are you headed next?"
"I intend to patrol the perimeter of the atrium, and..."
With no warning whatsoever, a ginger tomcat sailed over the garden wall and sprinted toward them. Kettle let out a brief sound of surprise, his hand darting toward his sword on reflex. The cat hurtled up to Esterbrook and slid to a halt with a long, chewy-sounding burble of throaty sound. Esterbrook blinked down at the cat and held up a hand.
"Wait, wait, slow down."
The cat seemed to bound back and forth in place, stiff-legged, as if he could barely keep himself from breaking into another sprint. The stream of agitated feline sound continued.
"The beastie's gone mad, sir?"
Kettle asked.
"Not mad, I think," Grimm said.
"Mr. Esterbrook, can you understand him?"
"I only speak a bit,"
Esterbrook said.
"He's... there... danger. Help. Those I understood."
He shook his head.
"What danger? Who needs help?"
"Wait," Kettle said. "I know they're clever beasts, but do you mean the things actually talk?"
The cat turned two frantic circles and then darted over to the corpse of a fallen Auroran marine in his stolen uniform. He stopped to make sure they were all looking at it and then deliberately swiped the dead man's chest, hissing.
"More of them?"
Esterbrook said.
"Like that one?"
The cat made another sound that Grimm could have sworn was an exasperated affirmative.
"Merciful builders,"
Kettle breathed.
"Is the man serious?"
"My bosun on Perilous kept a cat aboard," Grimm said. "The little monster was not to be underestimated."
He looked up at Esterbrook.
"Is this creature known to you?"
"Yes,"
Esterbrook said at once.
"He is. His name is Raoul."
"Then it would appear I know where I'm going next.
Grim said calmly. Raoul whirled to look directly at Grim, wide eyes intense. Then he let out another mrowling sound and darted back toward the wall of the garden. He leapt to the top and paused to look back over his shoulder.
"Mr. Creedy," Grim called. "We're moving out."
"Aye, sir," Creedy said. "Where are we headed, Captain?"
Raoul leapt down and darted into the dimness, pausing 30 yards later to look back. Grim started moving, Kettle at his side.
"At the quick march, Mr. Creedy. Follow that cat."